Alright, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Torah Studies. This is our weekly look at the Torah portion. So the Torah portion this week is, what is it? It's a trick question. Vayakel Pekudei. It's a trick question because it's a double portion. I did the old double fake out. So here we go. Vayakel Pekudei, you can find it beginning on page 584. That is Vayakel. And then Pekudei begins on page number 602. So it's a really long Torah portion. It's a really long section that we're reading. It's double portion. We have 92 verses plus another 122 verses, totaling many, many verses, over 200 verses that we're going to read this week. So it's a very long portion. And Vayakel Pekudei really finishes up the Torah's narrative of the Mishkan, building the Mishkan. The Torah tells us that the God told Moshe how to build it. He gave him the specs, gave him the details. Then we were interrupted. That was two portions had the instruction about how to make the Mishkan, how to make the tabernacle, and how to make the clothes for the Kohen and the Kohen Gadol. And then we had one portion kind of interrupt the narrative with the story of the sin of the golden calf. That was last week's Torah portion. And then this week we pick up once again with the building of the actual Mishkan of the tabernacle and the appointment of the Kohanim, the priests, and the inauguration of the priests, and everything gets ready for opening day of the tabernacle. So that's kind of these two portions, which are the last two of the book of Exodus.
How did you call the parasha?
Vayakel and Pekudei.
Ah,
Pekudei, yeah. So Vayakel, again, 584. And here Moshe, right at the beginning, Moshe gathers the people. And he says, this is what God told me that I should tell you about the construction of this Mishkan, this home for God. This is what we need. These are the items that we're looking for you to donate. These are the different jobs that need to be done. These are the different items that need to be built, etc., etc., etc. And he lists all of the things that God told him. And then we read about the actual appointment of the builders on 589. We were introduced to the appointment of Bezalel and Oholiab. These are the two primary builders that oversaw the construction of the Mishkan and creating all of those details that went into it. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. Let's jump in. Oh, you should know, today's class is all about art. It's all about art. Life as art and art as life. And about the place of artistic contribution and creativity within Judaism. Just so you know, that's the core discussion. But let's begin.
Why did they choose somebody of 13 years old? Bezalel was only 13?
He was only 13?
Why did they choose such a young boy?
Is this legit that he was 13?
Yes.
Interesting. We have a bunch of Bezalel truthers here. I'm kidding. I don't even know what that means. Why so young? He must have been very talented. The Torah says that he was very talented, very creative. In fact, we'll have a Ramban soon, and I'm realizing that my textbook is elsewhere. I have to get it in a second. We're going to have a Ramban in Nachmanides that says that you have to understand how amazing Bezalel was. He grew up in Egypt. What were they doing in Egypt? You think they were working with gold and precious metals, and they weren't working. They were working with clay and mud and bricks and mortar, right? That's what they were working with. So the fact that he was so talented and so skilled to be able to create these beautiful, intricate, and ornate pieces was truly a gift from above. Okay, so let's begin. Ray, please get us started. 589. While you read, I'm going to deftly segue and get my book. It's either in the office or maybe even in my vehicle. Either way, but read slowly, and by the time you end, I'll pick it up.
Right, so where am I starting?
589, right in the middle of the page. I'll tell you where to start and where to stop. So again, 589, appointment of Bezalel and Oholiab, where Moshe said, and I want you to go, please, until until the end of that section on 591, where it has the next header. Okay. All right, please. Hold on 1 second. Please begin.
Appointment of Bezalel and Oholiab. Moshe said to the children of Israel, "See, God has appointed Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Yehuda. He has filled him with the Spirit of God, with wisdom, with insight, with divine inspiration, and with the ability for all types of work, to do master weaving, to work with gold, silver, and copper, with the craft of setting gems, and with the craft of wood, to do all kinds of skilled work. God gave both him, Bezalel, and Oholiab, the son of Ahisamach, of the tribe of Dan, the ability to teach others. He instilled within them the wisdom of heart required to perform all the skills of a craftsman, an artistic weaver, an embroiderer, and a weaver using turquoise, purple, and crimson wool and linen. They are able to do all kinds of work and weave professionally. But Bezalel and Oholiab should do all the work together with every wise-hearted man and whom God had instilled wisdom and insight to know how to do all the work of the holy sanctuary in accordance with everything which God has commanded. Moshe called Bezalel and Oholiab and every wise-hearted man into whose heart God had instilled wisdom, everyone whose heart inspired him to dedicate himself to do the work. They took before Moshe all the contributions which the children of Israel had offered for the work of the holy sanctuary. They continued to bring him more donations every morning.
Okay, great. Thank you. So what we have here is the appointment of Bezalel and Oholiab, and that they are now running the show as far as the actual construction and getting this beautiful edifice built. I want to point out something right away, and that is there's a very strange phrase here. Wise-hearted. You notice that? Wise-hearted? Every wise-hearted person. But in the Hebrew, it's chacham lev. Chacham lev. Chacham is wise. Lev is heart. So the translation here goes wise-hearted. I don't know if that's a thing. There's not even a hyphen there. Pretty sure if you type in the old Word doc, wise-hearted, it'll throw you a squiggly right there and be like, that does not exist. You might want to change that. What does it mean, wise-hearted? Why do you? What do you think it means that these individuals were wise of heart? What does that mean? Wisdom is in the mind, right?
Maybe.
Sorry, it looks like you got some. But what's with the heart?
Because the heart's where the artistic
energy is. Is creativity in the heart or is it creativity in the mind?
Passion.
Passion?
Yeah.
Okay.
Passion for the arts.
So you're channeling the passion. I like it. Cool.
Heart has something to do with feeling.
With feeling. So not only are they...
Everything comes from the brain, but...
Right. But still, that's what we say, yeah. So in other words, not only are they wise in mind, but they also have, you know, there's IQ and EQ. There's a measurement of intelligence, the IQ, and then there's EQ, which is emotional intelligence. It seems like they had to be not only smart in their mind, in their head, but also passionate, excited, artistic. They had to have a feel for things that's not just... You have to sense things as well. There's a great story it's a fantastic story about a Rav. Who was it? A very famous Rav. I'm forgetting the name. Anyway, so somebody came to him before Passover, one of the people in the community, and he said, "Tell me the law. Am I allowed to, instead of using 4 cups of wine on Passover for the Seder, can I use 4 cups of milk?" So the rabbi you know, he begins to look very, like he's very seriously contemplating the question, and he says, it's a great question, and I need to look up the answer, but it's so close to Passover, it's going to take me too long. In the meantime, he opens up a drawer, pulls out some money, he says, take this money and buy what you need for the Seder. And the man is very thankful, and he goes home. There was somebody there that overheard this conversation. He said to the rabbi, what's going on? It's an obvious answer that you can't use milk for the Seder. It has to be a great product. So why didn't you just say no? So he said like this, look, if this guy's asking if he can use milk, it means he doesn't have money for wine. But in addition to that, it means he doesn't have money for any meat or anything meat at the Seder. Because if you're drinking milk throughout the Seder, you're 4 cups of wine, it means you're not having any meat. So obviously this person does not have money for supplies. So I could recognize from his question that what he needs is not an answer to this halakhic theoretical question, but he needs some money to buy provisions for the Seder. And so I think, I don't know if it's exactly lining up, but you know, it's one thing to know the answer, to have wisdom in mind, but there's also another metric, and that is to have not only a kind heart, but to be wise of heart, to recognize, to know what the situation calls for. Maybe we would call it street smarts in a different context, but it means to understand things and to know what needs to be done. Sorry?
To understand what's going on.
To understand what's going on, to understand what's required, what's needed, what we should do, how to be a little bit flexible and how to be resilient. All of these things are not necessarily intelligence. These are more connected with the heart. And so the Torah tells us, that Betzalel and Eliyahu, they not only were very smart and very very wise, but they were wise-hearted. They had this other dimension as well that helped them in this project. Because as we'll see, there were a lot of details that weren't necessarily spelled out. As much as the Mishkan is discussed in detail, there are still certain details that were not fully discussed. And Betzalel and Eliyahu, mainly Betzalel, he was like the head of the two, Betzalel had to kind of on his own figure out and discern what it is that God wanted, what it is that would make for the best type of Mishkan, home for God. Okay, so now let's take a look. How did Betzalel merit to be such a great individual? So let's segue over to the Torah Studies booklets. Take a look. Jillian, please read this one in the Torah Studies on page 186, text 2a. The Midrash explains the origins of Betzalel's wisdom.
Betzalel merit to be so wise. It was in Miriam's merit. As the Torah says, he established households for the midwives. What were these houses? The houses of the priesthood and the houses of royalty. Yochebed, mother of Moses, took as her reward. Aaron, her son, became the high priest, and Moses was king. The king in Yerusha. Miriam, for her part, took the house of wisdom, since Betzalel was descended from her. She was also part of King David's lineage, as Ephrat gave birth to Hur, and David is called a descendant of Ephrat. Ephrat is, in fact, another name of Miriam.
Boom, there we go. So the Midrash tells us, so who was Betzalel? Again, Betzalel, the Torah says, Betzalel ben Uri ben Chur. Right? Betzalel's father was Uri. His grandfather was Chur. Who was Chur? Chur was the son of Miriam. So his great-grandmother, Betzalel, the craftsman guy, the wise-hearted fellow who built this whole thing, like on the ground, Betzalel's great-grandmother was Miriam, sister of Moshe and Aaron. And the Medrash says that how did he merit to be so wise and so wise of heart? Because of what his great-grandmother did. When Pharaoh told the Egyptian midwives to kill all the boys, Miriam and her mother Yocheved, instead of killing the boys, they went and rescued the boys. And they made sure that they would live and be healthy, etc. And so Yocheved, Moshe's mother, Miriam's mother, she merited the priesthood. Her son became the Kohen Gadol, Aaron, right? And Miriam, the daughter, her family She gave birth to a family of wise individuals, including Bezalel, and then it says King David as well. Okay.
Well, who is Shifra and Pua?
That's a euphemism, or that's a nickname for Yocheved and Miriam. Yeah. So Shifra and Pua, Rashi says that this refers to the sounds that they would make to the babies to soothe them and to make them happy and smile and not cry and whatever. So they would a shifra, I think, is maybe they used to, she straightened the limbs. She straightened the limbs of the babies when they were born. And pua is maybe that's what the sounds that whatever. Either way, it's Yocheved and Miriam that would help birth the children even amidst that decree. Okay, so that's a little bit about the origins of Bezalel. Now let's do another text. Debbie, you're up for text 2b.
Why is her mentioned here as the father of Bezalel? Because when the children of Israel sought to worship the idol of the golden calf, Hur gave his life for God to prevent it. God told him, "On your life, I will repay you." This is analogous to a king against whom there is a rebellion. The minister of the king's army stands up and fights the rebels, declaring, "You are rebels against the king." He is eventually slain by the rebels. The king says about him, "If I were given money when I needed it, I would repay the loan. All the more so if one gave their life for me." Therefore, the king appoints all his descendants, his ministers, and representatives of the king in his stead. So too, when the Jews attempted to make the golden calf, Hur gave his life. God said, "All of your descendants I will raise to eternal renown." Therefore, the verse says, God called on the name of Bezalel and filled him with the Spirit of God.
Thank you. So here we have some incredible origins of Bezalel. His great-grandmother is Miriam. And his grandfather is Hur. Hur is the one who, when the Jews first made the golden calf, so he stood up and said, "Hey, this is wrong." Aaron famously tried to push them off, come back tomorrow, whatever. But Hur stood up and said, "This is wrong," and they killed him. So the Midrash says that in that, it's like a king. Somebody stands up for him, so he rewards the family of the individual that was killed, standing up for his honor. So Hashem rewarded his grandson, Bezalel, with this wisdom and this ability to create this beautiful Mishkan. Now, let's take a look at text 3a. These are all very, very fascinating texts. The Talmud tells us a little bit about Bezalel's intuition when it comes to the Mishkan. Now, again, this idea of intuition is very important, and I actually like that word now that I've just said it. Intuition, it's not only knowledge, like book smarts, it's intuition. It's to be able to intuit, to figure out what needs to happen in a certain situation. But Saul had a lot of intuition, as we see in text 3a. Sarah.
So intuition could be wise heart?
Now that I'm saying it, I think that might be a good translation. What do I know? No, I think it might be a good way of framing it. Sarah, take it away, please. Text 3a, page 188.
God told Moses, "Go and tell Bezalel to make a tabernacle for me with an ark and other furnishings." Moses, though, reversed the order and said to Bezalel, "Make an ark, furnishings, and a mishkan."
Do you see the difference? So the God's instruction is first the tabernacle, i.e. the building, the structure, then the ark, and then the other vessels. Moses reverses the order and says, make the ark, the other vessels, and then the tabernacle around it. Continue.
Bezalel replied, "Our teacher Moses, the usual practice is to build a house and then bring in furniture. You are telling me to make an ark, furnishings, and then a mishkan. Where will I be placing the furniture that I will be building? Perhaps God instructed you this way. Perhaps God instructed you this way. Make a mishkan, then an ark and other furniture." He's asking, did God instruct you?
He's trying to tell him nicely, like,
maybe God told you.
You might want to check those facts. But he didn't say it. He said, "Maybe, perhaps God..." Perhaps the order that you said it is not specific. Maybe God told you a different order.
Said Moses to him, "Were you Bezalel?" Am I supposed to say that?
It's in the shadow.
Yeah. So Bezalel means Bezalel and then God's name. It means in the shadow of God. So he's saying, Bezalel, were you standing there when we were having this conversation? How did you know? Again, intuition. He kind of intuits what initially God's command is. There's another wonderful teaching. This is text 3b. Amy, please read this. Let's skip. Well, okay, 3b says Bezalel knew how to arrange the letters by which heaven and earth were created. He knew even how to create cosmic change as well. Okay, but let's read text 4. Amy, please read text 4 about the menorah and Bezalel's wisdom.
When God told Moses, make the menorah of pure gold, Moses said, how should it be made? He was told it should be hammered out of a solid block. Nonetheless, Moses found it difficult to understand, and when he came down from Mount Sinai, he forgot how to make it. God said to him, go to Bezalel, he can make it. And indeed, Moses asked Bezalel, and he immediately was able to make it. Moses was astonished. God showed it to me several times that I couldn't understand how to make it. Yet you, who never saw it, were able to make it on your own. Bezalel, you must have been standing, Bezalel, in the shadow of God when he showed me how to make the menorah.
I love that. Right? Isn't it nice? Such a cute, like such a nice saying, in the shadow of God when he was showing me and communicating with me. Okay. Fine. Here we have text 5. This is again what I mentioned at the beginning of the class. Nachmanides, Ramban, talks about how just absolutely incredible Bezalel's abilities were given the very practical, pragmatic origins and upbringing of Bezalel. Text 5, Mike.
When Israel were slaves in Egypt, they toiled with brick and mortar and not the fine materials of silver, gold, copper, and precious gems. They never saw such wealth. It is thus miraculous that they found a man amongst them who was a master of metallurgy, woodwork, and weaving. Even among those who apprenticed in these fields, you never find a single man who is a master of all of them. And even if there were Hebrews who were learned in these fields, years of working with their hands in clay and straw could have ruined their ability to work in fine arts. Furthermore, Bezalel was extraordinarily wise to understand the secrets of the Mishkan and its vessels, to grasp the reason for each one and to what they symbolically refer. Therefore, God told Moses to appreciate this miracle and know that he had bestowed Bezalel with the Spirit of God so he would understand how to build the Mishkan in the desert for his glory.
So again, we see here from the Ramban that Bezalel, Ramban does a really good job, I think, of bringing out this idea of how talented he was. He was an expert with metallurgy. Sounds like someone who's allergic to metal, but whatever. He was an expert in metal, woodwork, weaving, all these different fields. So how do you have one guy who's an expert, who's a maven in all of these ideas, in all of these fields, especially a guy who grew up in Egypt, slavery, working with bricks and clay and straw, and somebody whose hands would have, you know, lost that fine touch, perhaps, working with such crude materials. And yet, there he was, doing his thing and being an expert at all this. So, point is, extolling the wisdom and the talents and the abilities and the discernment and the intuition of Bezalel. Okay, text 6 and text 7 talk about Aholiyav. Aholiyav was the other right-hand man, if you will, was the other head builder. And we don't know a lot about Aholiyav. Seems like Bezalel is coming from this wonderful lineage. His great-grandmother is Miriam, his grandfather is Hur, who gave his life to try to stop the golden calf. Aholiyav seems to be just the guy who could get the job done. And there's also a lesson there, as the commentaries point out. We don't have it here, and it's really not part of this class specifically. But the message is, you don't have to be Bezalel to be able to be, number one, to be skilled, and number two, to build God's Mishkan. You can even be an Aholiyav, just a regular person. The tribe of Dan, famously the tribe of Dan, when all the tribes would travel in formation, the tribe of Dan, they were the last ones to travel. Do you know this? When they in formation, when they moved through the desert, it was very much orchestrated and choreographed. The tribe of Dan, Sheva Dan, they were the last. And you know what their job was? You ever been camping before? Have you ever been the last one on the campsite? And you realize, oh my gosh, they left everything for me to pick up. It's the worst. There's a blanket and now a tent and a battery and plates and what's and baked beans and what is this? My car is already full. What am I supposed to do with all this stuff? Right? I'm not speaking from personal experience, maybe. Anyway, when you're the last, you had 2 million people camping. You would imagine a few things would be left. A few things, right? Lucky a few things. Many things were left. And so Shevet Dan, the tribe of Dan, their job was literally, they were the lost and found. I mean, that wasn't their only job, but that was part of their job. They were the lost and found, the Jewish lost and found. And at the next time they camped, they would go out, they would, you know, they'd post probably somewhere online pictures and, hey, is this yours? You know, like the schools do. They put everything out on a table. Huh? Oh, camp. Oh, that's the worst. Oh my gosh, are you kidding me? We just give the kids, just there's no expectations. Because once you have expectations, if your kids come back with camp with something, even a shirt, or their shirt, just setting yourself up for disappointment. Not you, me. I'm setting myself up for disappointment. The expectation is they will not come back with anything of theirs. Whatever they do come back with has to be detoxed and or thrown out anyway. So it's good to go. Camp. Yeah. So that's what it was. 4 years of camping. And Shevet Dan, the tribe of Dan, they were the lost and found. Now, the lost and found is an important position, but it's not necessarily what's going to be in lights on Broadway. I don't know why any of these tribes would be in lights, but work with me here. So it's not like the most, in Hebrew you would say chashuv, it's not like the most prominent position to be the one that picks up after everybody. And yet, so that's where Eliyahu comes from. That was his tribe. And yet the Torah tells us he was also skilled. And he took a leading role in building God's first temple on earth. Now, we don't have a lot about his lineage, and we don't have a lot about his pedigree, if you will. What we do have is the fact that many generations later, a descendant of his was one of the people who worked on building the Beit HaMikdash, the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. When King Solomon built a temple, he used a builder from Shevet Dan, from the tribe of Dan, a descendant from Eliyahu, to help build the Mishkan. That's found in text 6 and text 7. I'm paraphrasing because I want to move to the next section. And so what we see here is, of course, the apple does not fall far from the tree. Now, let's explore one more text. Rambam, Maimonides. Sandrine, are you up to reading text 8:194? This is about, I will say, this is not about the Mishkan, the tabernacle. This is about the Beit HaMikdash, the temple in Jerusalem, which was a more permanent structure as opposed to the movable travel version of the temple that was the tabernacle. This was the more solid version. But the point, we want to extract the point from this, which we'll see in a moment. Text 8. And so, thank you. So what Rambam is telling us is that when you build a Beit HaMikdash, when you build a temple, you can add on some extra flair. You don't have to keep it only to like, okay, it has to be built of stone and it has to be... You can add a little extra gold gilding. You can add on some bling to the temple to make it that much nicer. There's a mitzvah to beautify it. And the same thing is true with the Mishkan. And Bezalel, we know from the sources that we read and other sources, Bezalel and Eliyahu, but Bezalel mainly, he was very creative and he knew how to use his talents in building a home for God. Now, this leads us into our larger conversation, or perhaps more, I would say more relevant. I mean, it's Torah, it's all relevant, but I guess personal, more personal conversation, which is, what is the place of artistic expression or and or creativity in Judaism. So when people, I think, when people think of Judaism, especially halakha, Jewish law, so it feels a little bit rigid. Maybe that's a nice way of putting it. Rigid. Very structured. Right? You open up the code of Jewish law and it begins with how you wake up in the morning. Yitkaber ka'ari, wake up like a lion. Or wake up like me. Now, wake up like a lion. And don't be afraid from anyone that mocks and scoffs and moda'ani and wash your hands. And it's almost like every step of your day is being spelled out in halakha and Jewish law. And so one might say, down to how you tie your shoelaces, which we've talked about before. We've talked about this before, right?
I mean, maybe.
Maybe. So halakha says like this, you always get dressed right side first before left side. Because right is chesed, and left is gevura. It's a mystical explanation of it. Right is kindness, and left is severity. So we always want the dominant, the first approach to be one of kindness and love and generosity and giving, so that we channel that energy from above. Okay. So you put in your right, you put your right foot in. Even in the hokey pokey, it's right first, isn't it? Is it, right? That's what it's all about. Da-da-ba-da-ba-bam.
Is that why you put your jacket like on half sleeve?
Yeah, well, that so we put the tefillin. We put the tefillin on the so tefillin goes on the left, goes on the weaker arm. So if you're righty, and that's from a biblical inference about how a word is written. So it goes on the weaker hand. So I'm a righty, so I put it on my left arm. So therefore, I leave the left jacket sleeve hanging, and so that I can get the tefillin on. But here's the thing: when you get dressed, Halacha says, Yerushalayim says, put the right sleeve in first, left sleeve in, pants this way, and shoes also. Right sock, left shoe, and then you tie the left shoe first. Didn't see that coming. Right? Again, right sock, left shoe, and then stay at the left shoe, tie it, and then move back to the right shoe. Why? Because of tefillin. Just like tefillin, you tie in the left arm, so you tie the left shoe first. Does that mean if you're a lefty, you should tie the right shoe first? I'm not sure. You have to ask a lefty. So here's the point. Halacha, Jewish law, is very specific and gets down even to shoelaces. How you cut your nails?
What about tefillin for lefty?
You put in the right arm. So that's what I'm saying. Do you also tie your right shoe? I'm not sure. You have to ask a lefty. You have to find a lefty to ask. And even to cutting your nails. You cut your nails, it says in Jewish law not to cut them in order. Not to cut them in sequential order. You should skip 1, 3, 5, 2, 4. That's what it says. I have to look up the sources to see if there are reasons given. I'm sure there are reasons for it. But it says you should skip a finger in between. Listen, so the point is that halacha is very precise. There's a lot of stuff that's in Jewish law. Now, a person would say, talk about the opposite of creativity. Creativity, artistic expression. So, we're very happy for Bezalel. Bezalel was an artist, and he found his calling. God says, I need a building. Bezalel says, sign me up. And he goes to town. He's building menorahs. He's hammering it out of gold, one piece of solid gold, making flowers and circles and ornate situations. And he's going, you know, he's going all out in this temple. Wonderful. But is there a place for you and I, if we're creative, is there a place within Judaism for creativity? Is there a place within halakha, Jewish law, for creativity? And really the question is twofold. Number one, it seems like the rules of Jewish law might stifle creativity, right? It might be a little suffocating, like, oh, I have to do this, I have to do that, so I can't be creative, I can't be an artist. And the second point is, well, what if somebody is an artist? In other words, what is Judaism about? Is it about the ritual law? And then ritual law means, you know, you're doing this mitzvah and that mitzvah and the other mitzvah. Making a painting is not part of Jewish law. Right? And you don't make a painting. You probably paint a painting. But yeah. Right? So painting is not composing. Is that part of halacha? Is that part of Judaism? So the question is, if you're an artist, is there a place within Judaism? Now, we know the answer is going to be yes, but let's explore the process for a second. The first question first. How do we understand how you can have creativity and artistic expression within the guidelines of halacha? So I want to point out one thing, and that is that almost all creativity is born of limitation. This is a fact. Almost all creativity is born of limitation. And I don't only mean necessity is the mother of invention, which is also true. But think about poetry. And think about a sonnet. Different structures of poetry where things have to rhyme, but with certain number of syllables per line and a certain number of lines, right? It's very structured about how you write. You ever read Dr. Seuss? Dr. Seuss operates with a very structured formula. That's why there's a rhythm to it. You read the pages and there's a rhythm to the reading. Not only are the words rhyming or doing their thing, but also every line has the same number of syllables and the same, there's a rhythm to it, which is structure. And you would think, you want to be artistic, you want to be expressive, so do away with structure. It's not the case. Structure is what actually allows the unbridled, if you will, or unlimited artistic possibilities to actually find a place of expression. In other words, because of the limitations of the space that you have, or the medium that you're using, or the structure that you're in, because of that, it actually brings out the artistic, or it allows you to be artistically creative. Michelangelo, using a certain size canvas, or a certain size, you know, whatever it is, or certain various medium in sculpting, so whatever it is that you're using, that brings out the creativity. It doesn't only bring it out, but allows it to have a certain type of expression. You know, you typically think of an artist as, okay, fill in the blank. So an adjective before the word artist, blank artist. What else? What else?
Inspired.
What else? Oh, man, what else? No one's getting it. What do you usually hear about artists?
Poor.
There's a word for it.
Starving
artist, right? You think of an artist as someone creative, you know, not making a lot of money, but painting because he or she loves it, and it's all about the art, and it's all about the craft, and there's not a lot of other stuff going on. You don't typically think of an artist as somebody extremely wealthy, living in a mansion, painting in a loft. Although that could also be, you know, but an artist, there's something that, there's a certain creative energy that's born of the challenge. The greatest comedians are the ones with the most difficult upbringings, right? Or the most difficult stories, most painful stories, breeds comedy. That's the way it is. Look at comedians. They've gone through stuff, right? It's like, oh, I woke up today, got into my Jaguar, went to work, and made a killing on a deal. That's not funny. There's zero funny about that. So artistic expression, I mean, I don't know, it's wonderful, but it's not funny. I mean, it's like... An artist painting someone else's Jaguar is funny. That's funny. I'm kidding, that's vandalism, and it's funny. And the point is like this, that artistic expression is actually enhanced when you have parameters and limitations. And let's go now to a beautiful article, text 9. The example that's used is not of art. Oh, I didn't even mention music, but this is something we mentioned before. Music, yeah. Now, Moritz Asara, of course, is known, also known as Moritz Asara, is a composer and a musician.
So little children, when I teach them, this wasn't my idea, they learn a five finger, just the first five notes of a scale, in a lot of different keys. And it's defined as a rule as to how they have to be arranged to make a major sound, how they have to be arranged to make a minor sound. But within that structure, they can create beautiful questions and answers using that structure. That's just a very simple explanation. And one child's question and answer in the same key may be quite different from another person's question and answer in the same key, but they're both using the key of G major.
Right.
So there's a definition of their limits, but within those limits, they can find sounds that they really like. But like Beethoven's an example. Beethoven grew up in he was composing in a certain definite structure, but he, toward the end of his life, was going way out of that. He was going more toward the next period of music. But he couldn't have, I don't know whether he could have done that had he not all begun in that structure.
Right.
Like that structure, the structure doesn't limit you.
The structure provides.
It allows you to tap your creativity.
It gives you parameters.
You have nothing that you don't know where to start or finish or what.
Right. It's the fact that the canvas is a beginning and an end gives you a space within which to work to express your creativity. So you could say, oh, this canvas, however large it is, oh, come on, you're limiting me. Or you can say, perfect, now I have a place within which to work. So this is a way to look at Judaism. Halacha gives you a structure. Not a very detailed structure, but it gives you a structure within which now you can be creative, you can work within the structure. We're going to use an example of writing and editing and text. Text 9 is actually a beautiful example. It's very long. David, you're up to it.
As a writer, I come to realize the importance of a good editor. Every journal or publication has one. He or she is the person who guards the mandate for publication. The person who decides which articles will see the light of day and which do not fit into the parameters of what's acceptable, and who suggests, insists on the changes to be made in the content or content and wording. I've also come to see that there are varying calibers and styles in editors. There are those editors who edit too loosely. They give free rein to their authors, leaving mistakes, abstruse sentences, or plain old weak writing unchecked. Lacking vision, they neglect to establish a concrete focus for their publication. Creativity thrives, but chaos abounds. Then there are those editors who edit too stringently. They consistently delete whole paragraphs, replace your ideas and expression with their own, until original piece becomes hardly recognized. The finished product might read perfectly, but it has practically become the editor's creation instead of yours. What difference is a really top-notch editor like the one here at the Chabad organization from the mediocre is the rare knack of setting strong guidelines while at the same time allowing the unique talent and flavor of each author to shine through. The ideal editor may be a great writer himself. He may theoretically have been able to express the same ideas and feelings presented in the article you have submitted better than you have. But he understands his writers need to author their independent creations, and he also understands that in the end result, allowing his writers to express themselves in their own different and varied ways will result in a better article and a better publication. So though he will polish, weed out and improve, discarding, replacing and adding words, ideas or sentences in accordance with his established criteria and grand plan, he'll make sure to maintain the unique style of the author's work. He'll choose the author's words and expression over his own, even while correcting or enhancing. He'll work together with the author to develop a piece that is on track, watching that it doesn't lose focus and become sidetracked from its goal, even while allowing the author's exploration along the way. In life, we are presented with many choices. In these choices, we become authors of our destiny. Every path that we tread, every turn we take, composes a fresh new sentence, paragraph or chapter in our life. This combines to develop into our unique life stories, worded with our contribution and innovations, styled by our special personality and talents, and marked with our mistakes and slip-ups. And throughout it all, our ultimate editor is overseeing our project, watching carefully that we don't get sidetracked from our true mandate and goal, helping us to realize which choices might work better, while still permitting us free choice. Despite his munificent guidance to get us to our end goal, he still enables us to find our own voice and to author our unique creation. Because he knows that the way to get from us the very best story we can do.
Thank you. That's a very long text. Thank you for reading that. That's from an author, Chana Weisberg, printed on Chabad.org. And her point is very well taken. And it's that a good editor has guidelines, but within the guidelines allows for the creativity of the individual. And her point is that Hashem, God, does the same thing for us. God establishes guidelines. The Torah sets forth guidelines of what it means to live a good life and what it means to live a healthy life, etc. Within those guidelines, though, we have many different choices that we make and many different permutations of where we go and how we do it, etc., which create the diversity and that creative expression. So you can have both. You can have the structure and you can have the creativity. So that addresses the first question. The second question that we asked before is, yeah, but practically speaking, if you're an artist, yeah, is that a Jewish thing? Is being an artist a Jewish thing? It's not a mitzvah in the Torah to paint something or to compose music. So how does that fit in? So we're going to take a beautiful teaching from this week's Torah portion found in text 10a, and let's see, text 10a and 10b, and we'll frame it, we'll look at it the way the Rebbe looks at it to address this question. So before we do this, let me just give you a quick background information about this. In the opening of the Torah portion, actually right before the verses that Ray read at the beginning of the class that talk about Betzalel's appointment, Betzalel and Aliyev's appointment, so the Torah talks about all of the contributions that the people gave. They gave the gold, they gave the copper, they gave the silver, they gave the various materials, etc. And it tells us something that the women, it says, V'chol ha'nashim, all of the women, that the women contributed. So let's read it here in text 10a. Doctor.
All the women whose hearts inspired them with wisdom spun the goats.
So this is what the Torah tells us. The women whose hearts inspired them with wisdom, again, you have the idea of heart and wise, spun the goats. What were they doing? Like, they put them on a huge, like, lazy Susan and spun them around, spin the goats. Who does that? I've seen goats on the roof. You see that? There's like a place. No. There's literally a place, like, in North Georgia, near Camp Ramah. Goats on the roof.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And they're like on the roof.
Yeah.
They're actual goats on the roof. Anyway, but that's not spinning the goats. That's just putting them at a higher elevation. It's made of straw. Yeah. Yeah, or whatever it is. It's very interesting, right? How do they get them down from there? How do they get them up there? A ladder? Goats climb. There you go. I don't have enough goats in my life. I don't know these things. I'm just saying. Now, when I was a kid, by the way, goat, when you called, not anyone should, but you called someone a goat, it was a negative, it had a negative thing, right? Now it's like the greatest compliment.
By the way.
Because it stands for greatest of all time, right? So that's like, that's the newest flavor. Yeah, they say Tom Brady is like the goat, but in a good way. Okay, now, so text 10a is the women spun the goats. What does it mean the women spun the goats? Now, goats, obviously, what grows What grows? What are they? Yeah, grows. The wool. Doesn't say they spun the wool from the goats. They spun the goats. So Rashi explains 10b. Please continue.
This constituted a superior skill, for they, the women, spun it on the backs of the goats.
They spun the wool while it was still attached to the goats. Why did they do that? What? Well, they did it in a way that wouldn't. I don't know. However, they did.
The goats liked it.
Yeah, it's like a thing. Now, so why did they do it though? Text 11. Alex, please read this one.
They spun the wool while it remained on the body of the goats, as the sages explain, to maintain its full luster. There are many materials that, once removed from their natural habitat, begin to decline in quality, such as bees, honey.
That's why if you eat the honey from a honeycomb, or maybe from a bee, no, I'm kidding, from the honeycomb, it's fresher as opposed to when you extract it, whatever. So when you spin the wool on the backs of the goats, it's got the full luster. So that's what happened. So the women, they spun the goats. They didn't make them dizzy, but they spun the wool on the goats, but on the goats themselves. And so the Rebbe says something amazing. The Rebbe says, why did they do this? First of all, this is an extreme talent to be able to do this. But what were they just showing off their talent? Why did they do this? They did it, as we see in text 11, because they wanted to give the best for the Mishkan. They wanted to give the best offering that they could give is not just cut wool that's spun, but spun wool on the backs of the goats that they then wove together. They hung up the goats on top of the tabernacle. They did not do that. They did not put the goats on top of the tabernacle. Ultimately, they did cut it off, but it maintained somehow in that spinning process the luster, and it was the best. And the Rebbe says, the Mishkan is a place where, what happened in the Mishkan? What was like the main service of the Mishkan and the Beit HaMikdash? What happened in the temple? What was the main service, generally speaking? Karbanot, offerings, sacrifices, offerings. The Rebbe says in a talk that this was the offering of these women. This is their karban. This was their, not sacrifice, but this is what they offered. This is what they gave of themselves. They gave, what did they give? Their best talent. They gave their greatest creativity. They gave. They didn't just do a job because they needed wool for the curtains. These were for the curtains. When I said the goats hanging on the curtains, the wool was hanging on the roof. That's what constituted the roof. It was made of these curtains, but without the actual goats. The point is, they did not just give their talents, but they gave the best of their talents. This was their offering. And the Rebbe says the lesson that we can learn from this, and this is text 12, which I'll read, is that you and I should use whatever talents we have for the purpose of Hashem, for a positive purpose. Text 12, I'm going to read this, page 200. The first lesson we learn from these women whose hearts inspired them with wisdom is that when God gives a person a certain knack or talent, they must know that it's not to be used solely for personal ends. Rather, in other words, to like spin your own original attached to goat sweater. No. Rather, in their mission to build a tabernacle and to make the world a habitat for God. We ought to be like the women of the tabernacle. They possessed a unique talent and they realized that it was a gift from God, that they were obligated to apply it in the building of the tabernacle to make a place for God's presence to dwell. These women were not specifically instructed to utilize this unique talent, yet they were motivated to do so on their own for God. The Torah records this narrative to impart a message for all time. So, and there's another lesson that the Rebbe learns from this. The first thing they made were these curtains from this wool. And the Rebbe said, why? The Rebbe says, why? Because once they spun the wool on the backs of the animal, to leave it there would actually bother the animal. So they cut it off immediately and they began to work on it. So that's why it was the first thing. So the Rebbe says, you don't even cause animals pain, so let alone, God forbid, another human being. We should do nothing to distress. We should never do something to distress another person. Okay, that's the second lesson. But the first lesson the Rebbe draws from this story is when you have a talent, it's been given to you by God for a purpose. You can use it for personal ends also, but also use it for your life's mission to make the world a home for God. Like the women who use their this incredible talent of spinning the goats to build literally a home for God, we should do the same. And so here we have the answer to our second question. The second question was, someone's an artist. Someone's an artist. So where do you find a place to be an artist in Judaism? Like, what are you going to do? You're going to light Shabbos candles with flair? Like, what are you going to do? You're going to eat kosher with more artistic presentation on your plate? Like, how are you going to use your artistic talent? And so the Rebbe says, you know, you use it, you paint. But painting's not a mitzvah. But painting can bring spiritual awareness into the world. Painting can make the world a better place and can bring people closer to Torah and mitzvot. And music can as well. Sarah, I'll mention that you've produced a few albums that teach children Jewish values and stories from Torah and about the Jewish holidays. So here we have an example of someone who's literally sitting, and I'm sure we all have this in our own way, someone who has a talent and a skill and has used it to literally to make the world a better, more godly place and to inspire and teach Jewish children. Yeah. Now that I've spoken about you, I'll let you speak also.
Thank you so much. But it seems that many very, very accomplished musicians, violinists and so mm-hmm. on, are Jews. And pianists and so on. Horowitz and
What's his name? The famous one. It's Perlman.
No, but something older than that. I can't think of it right now. So, but he was Jewish. But to get to for the thing that I never have been able to answer is God gave these people supreme talents in music. I mean, there's no I'm not in that league at all. And to develop that talent to that point, they had more or less to give their whole life. They're not going to be dominant three times a day. They're not going to be. That was their life. Is that okay? Is that?
Listen, we're not. I'm not judging anybody. And what the point? Listen, it's not for me to get into someone else's spiritual business. The point here that the Rebbe is saying, and that I'd like to convey here as well, you know, sharing this idea, this insight of the Rebbe, is that if I find that I have a talent, if you find that you have a talent, think about how you can use that talent for also for a higher purpose. By the way. The Rebbe, I've seen video where Herman Wouk is sitting at a Fabrengen, and the Rebbe is saying, there's someone here who's an author, and he has a mandate in his books to spread a positive, good message. Because that's his talent, and therefore it's a mandate. This was the Rebbe's approach to talents. Not that you should kill the talent and just, you know, study and meditate all day and pray and whatever, but use your talent. You have a talent, use it. And the Rebbe drew out, extracted this idea from this week's Torah portion. Why did they spin the goats? Why did they do this? Because that was the talent that they had. And that's building a home for God. It's not only lighting Shabbat candles. It's not only that. You can also, but it doesn't mean that we should therefore, it doesn't mean that I can only speak for myself, right? It doesn't mean that I should not do other stuff because I'm busy painting, which I'm not. I'm making stick figures at most. But that's not what it means. For me, it means that I can also use this in a unique way. So again, within the bigger picture, I can use these talents for something higher. We can use our talents for something higher. I want to share with you just very quickly as we conclude, there's a few things to mention here. There's three messages that the Rebbe gave to artists. One is text 13, one is text 14, and the other is, I'm assuming, text 15. Yes, I'm right. So text 13, it's a long text, but I'm going to paraphrase it. It's a letter that the Rebbe wrote in 1951, very shortly after he officially assumed the mantle of leadership of Chabad Lubavitch. And the Rebbe wrote this to an artist from Russia. A Chabad Hasidic artist whose name was Hendel Lieberman. He was born in 1900, and he was the brother of Mendel Futterfass, who was a chassid that we've spoken about many times. He was the older brother of Mendel Futterfass, who was in Siberia for many years. Anyway, he was so talented as an artist. He went to school in Moscow. He was first in the Chabad Yeshiva, Lubavitch Yeshiva, in the city of Lubavitch in Belarus, in White Russia. But then he enrolled in university in Moscow to take art. He won top prize in a national competition, artist competition, and he was given a 6-year scholarship to study art. Eventually, when he was almost 40, he was conscripted into the army, and he had to fight there, and he got injured a little bit, and when he came back home, his wife and kids, they had been murdered in the war. So he came back from the war. He was an artist, but he came back with nothing, no family, the whole deal. But he continued to create art. And in 1951, he wrote a letter to the Rebbe, basically saying that he's depressed and he's down and he's not too keen on life. And in text 13, and please read this at some point after the class, the Rebbe writes to him, saying that you're an artist, and the role of an artist is to see the deeper picture. What is an artist? An artist sees the depth, the truth of what something is, and is therefore able to express it on canvas or whatever medium that he or she is using. And so you as an artist, you're trained to look past the surface. So you may have experienced difficulty in life, but you channel your artistic vision that you display so beautifully in your art, channel that into how you approach life as well, and look at things in a deeper way. So here you see how the Rebbe gave a person guidance from their own field that they can relate to, which is a wonderful way to speak to people, address them on their on their level and where they're at and what they're into. So that's just a wonderful communication technique in general. But the other point is here what we see is how the Rebbe greatly respected art and the power of and what art is. Art is really seeing into the soul of the thing, and then putting the soul on display, which is a beautiful idea. Text 14 is a letter that the Rebbe wrote to a community about Jacques Lifshitz, who was a world-renowned sculptor. He was a cubist sculptor. I don't know what a cubist sculptor is, but Jacques Lifshitz knew what a cubist sculptor was because he was one. And the Rebbe writes in text 14 that what an artist, the gift of an artist is, text 13 he says, to see the soul of something. Text 14 he says, to take something that's dead and make it alive. You take a piece of metal that's dead, and you make it into a sculpture. You make it into something alive. You take materials that are otherwise lifeless, and you animate them with life. So you're taking basically matter and turning it into spirit. And he says, this is what an artist does, and this is what we're all meant to do. We're meant to take matter and make it spiritual, and make it alive, and make it vibrant. That's text 14. Again, read it after the class. Finally, text 15, the Rebbe talks about, again, a message drawn, all puns intended, drawn from art. And the Rebbe says that when you have art, good art always has an interplay of light and shadow. And it's not only the light that's beautiful, but the shadow is also beautiful because the shadow kind of brings out the light. When you have the right shadowing, it enhances the light. You wouldn't see the light without that shadow. And so the Rebbe is encouraging in this talk that's quoted in text 15, in this excerpt, that in life, when we go through moments of shadow, we should have the faith to recognize that this is only meant to enhance the light. So the moment of shadow should not break us. It's there to provide additional illumination through the light that follows, or for the adjacent light. Three messages. See deeply into something. Zogazont. Transform matter into spirit and see the light, the potential light inherent in shadow. The Rebbe respected art, and the Rebbe spoke glowingly of artists, but the point is to see the craft as a tool, as a teaching, as a message for something greater. So we each have our talents. If you can spin a goat, spin a goat. If you can spin records, spin records. You don't have to discard it. I've been asked many times, people are becoming more observant and, doing more Torah mitzvot and everything. And, life is a journey and everyone's on their own individual path within this larger journey. And the question I'm often asked is, okay, so, should I give up this? And should I, I have this talent, this ability, this degree, should I give it up and, go full-time studying Torah? The Rebbe's approach, it's hard to speak about the Rebbe's approach, but what we see from, because who am I to speak for the Rebbe, but what we see documented in these sources and others is an approach that says you don't have to discard your ability. It's God's gift, and it's meant to be used for something greater. So use it. You have a gift. You studied for something. You have a gift. You have a talent. Utilize it. Don't discard it. Utilize it, but utilize it for a greater purpose. Thank you very much for joining me today for Torah Studies.